So today we're looking at Dhammapada verse 308, which reads as follows. Seyo ayo gulo buto tato agisikupamo yanche bunjeya du silo rakta pindam asanyato. Which means, better an iron ball should be eaten, red hot like the flame of a fire, than one should eat immoral, the alms food of the nation, unrestrained. So this verse was taught in response to a story that we find actually in the Vinaya Pitaka under the fourth Parajika offense. The story goes that at that time the Buddha was staying in Vaisali, which is a city north of Bodh Gaya, quite far north of Bodh Gaya, north of Nalanda. In Bihar, India, what is now Bihar, India. And there was a group of monks living near a river at that time, and it came to pass that the country suffered a famine. And people procured food with great difficulty. There was hunger throughout the land, great suffering and hardship for the people, and as a result, hardship for the monks as well. The monks who depended on offerings from those who had food to spare and had faith and confidence enough to give away their hard-won food and their hard-won wealth to support the monks. So this group of monks, one group of monks that lived by the river near the city of Vaisali, got together and discussed amongst themselves how they should possibly be able to live. They had come upon the rains season where they couldn't just leave and go somewhere else. They had committed to stay in this monastery for the 3 months. And so they gathered together and tried to find a way to be able to live in comfort, live at ease, and I guess in their minds be able to practice the Buddha's teaching comfortably and efficiently. So one group of the monks suggested that they should be flexible and take up performing work for lay people, work for the householders. If we, as monks, do some sort of work for them, maybe we can build, maybe we can clean, maybe we can figure out, ask them what sort of work they need done, and then they'll give us food. This, of course, is not something that monks are allowed to do. As a monk, you've taken a vow to give up worldly affairs, to not get involved in worldly affairs, and to subsist only on that which is given freely without any sense of bargaining or transaction of any sort. Another group said, well, that sounds like a lot of work and it's quite a lot of bother. I've got something, someone suggested something maybe a little easier. What if we just run errands for people? So we can deliver things, we can deliver messages. We can perform this service for lay people, for householders. And if we do that, then people will give us food. another thing that monks are not allowed to get involved in. Because again, it's about giving up your dedication to renunciation and to poverty and to contentment, being content with whatever you get, whatever is given freely. But a third group said, well, that sounds all just like way too much work, too much bother. Why don't we just lie to the lay people? So we'll tell them that we're enlightened. But we won't do it directly, that's too obvious. We'll tell them about each other. So one of us will tell that another person is enlightened. They'll say, you know, that monk so-and-so, he's enlightened. Or this monk so-and-so has practiced meditation and has attained jhana. Or this monk can remember past lives. Or this monk has this magical power of some sort. We'll spread rumors about each other. And people will become so impressed that they will believe that by giving us charity, that it will be of great merit and great benefit to them to be a supporter of such a Buddhist monk. And they all agreed, well, that does sound like the easiest option. So clearly these monks were not that intent upon, not that wise in the ways of the Buddha's teaching or in ethical behavior of any sort. And so they did that. They undertook to spread rumors about each other, about their enlightenment, about false rumors about attainments and enlightenment, lying to the lay people, to the householders. And as a result, it worked quite well. Everyone began to get this impression that they were in the presence of greatness, excited that they had such highly attained individuals under their care, and became quite keen to offer the very best of what they had. It says in the text, they wouldn't even give to their parents, their children, their parents. They wouldn't give to anyone the way that they gave to these monks. They made sure that the monks got the best of what they had for themselves, thinking that these monks were something very special, something very great, and it was a rare opportunity for them to be able to support these religious people, religious con artists. As a result, the monks became quite well-fed, became healthy and physically fit. It even says they became fat. The monks became quite plump and fleshed out, while everyone else around them suffered. And they spent the 3 months in great comfort and luxury. Were able to get everything they needed, were able to pull off this scam quite well, and lived the 3 months of the rains in harmony and physical comfort, at least. At the end of the rains, as was the tradition, they went with all the other monks to see the Buddha, who was dwelling in Mahavana, the great forest near Vaisali. And of course, the difference was glaringly obvious, that unlike all the other monks in the area, these monks were fat and well-fed, and everyone around them was sickly and pale and struggling physically. And so the Buddha asked these monks, when they went to pay respect to the Buddha asked them, well, how was your dwelling in the rains? And they said, oh, we dwelt quite comfortably, Venerable Sir. And the Buddha, knowing full well that they hadn't come about this comfort legitimately, asked them, well, how is it that you spent the rains in such comfort, especially given that there was a famine and everyone else is around you is suffering. And they said, well, it was quite simple actually. We just told everyone we spread rumors about each other. And they told them exactly what they had said, that such and such a monk is enlightened, such and such a monk has this attainment or that attainment, spreading these rumors about each other, propping each other up. And the Buddha asked the simple question, is it true? These statements that you told, were they true? Now clearly, even if they were true, there's an issue there, right? And you can see the issue. The reason for saying it would be very much out of line with any sort of enlightenment or attainment in the Buddha's teaching. Very much out of line with goodness and harmony, peace. And no enlightened being would ever be inclined to take advantage of people's innate faith and desire to associate with enlightened beings to prop themselves up in this way. But of course they said, no, none of it was true. It was all a lie. And the Buddha scolded them, calling them useless, empty individuals. Moga Purisa, he said. And he said, this is the way of one of the great thieves in the world. Someone who lies about their spirituality to get the faith of those of ordinary people. And he laid down a rule that anyone who does this is no longer a monk. Anyone who lies about attainment is no longer a monk. And he taught this verse, saying that it's better that you should eat a red-hot iron ball than to eat the alms food given by the people of the world out of faith as one who is immoral, unethical, and untamed or unrestrained. So, the lesson here is actually quite important, especially relating to the practice of mindfulness. It addresses the issue of the commission of evil deeds in response to suffering. It addresses the issue of trying to fix our problems as a means of living a happy life. And within the realm of worldly affairs, within the system of birth, old age, sickness, and death, it somehow makes some sense to try and fix your problems. That when you have suffering, to find a way to free yourself from suffering. For most people, this doesn't translate into being an immoral, corrupt individual just to get basic necessities or even to find pleasure or happiness. But still, for most people in the world, it seems reasonable to perform acts, even acts of immorality, when confronted with sufficient suffering. So if you are starving, to steal food. If your family is starving, to steal food. If someone you love is under attack, to kill in self-defense, and so on and so on. It makes sense to people of the world, people without any experience in cultivating mindfulness and in practicing the Buddha's teaching, that one should have the capacity to fix one's problems, to react and to eradicate great suffering. We see this on so many levels. We see this on the level of society, where people will protest or even go to war, claiming that they have just reasons to kill, just reasons to fight, to defend themselves, to defend their land, their country. And by defend means to fight back, to kill, to harm others. People who believe it's right to steal from those who are corrupt, steal from those who hoard wealth, and so on. This all seems reasonable. It seems reasonable to get angry when people offend you, angry at people who are selfish, to fight, to argue, to defend yourself and your ability to survive comfortably. It might even seem reasonable for monks who are suffering, who are going hungry, to perform errands for lay people, to give up their dedication to renunciation, to work. You see this in throughout history in Buddhist countries, where monks give up are forced to give up their monastic life due to famine, due to war, due to hardship, just as a means of survival. It all seems reasonable. And why this is an important lesson, and why I can offer something that makes it seem unreasonable or a counterpoint to this, it speaks to the profundity of the Buddha's teaching, that it's not even so much that obviously immorality is going to lead to suffering. The actions of these monks, for example, is just such a horrific undertaking that it can only lead to great suffering for them in the future. But more importantly, and related, these sorts of actions signify buying into the illusion of samsara, the conceptual nature of life, that there is some meaning to wealth or to comfort, that there is something better about certain experiences than other experiences. When we try to protect ourselves or protect our family, when we become self-righteous, thinking we don't deserve this, our family doesn't deserve this, our country doesn't deserve this, or others, when we see others suffering, we say they don't deserve this. Conceptually, it can all be true. It can be true that the world is an unjust place. But the reality that exists behind all of that has no room for justice or injustice. The reality behind it is moments of experience. This is the reality that we experience right here, right now, in every moment. It's the reality that we come to see and we come to clearly observe in our practice of the Buddha's teaching, our practice of mindfulness. So we can say two things about why it is wrong to engage in immoral deeds as excused by the presence of great suffering. The first is that it doesn't work, that suffering and evil have the different characteristics that suffering doesn't lead to suffering. No matter how much you suffer, it doesn't have the power in and of itself to bring more suffering. Suffering is a result of something. But suffering doesn't have the effect on the mind to make you, to corrupt the mind and to cause you to do things that will bring about suffering. Unwholesomeness, evil. Evil deeds are the cause of suffering. The evil of greed, the evil of anger, the evil of delusion. These are the three things that cause suffering. This is an important truth about the Buddha's teaching and about the practice of mindfulness. That's very important for us to understand, and a reason why it's difficult often for meditators to fully accept the experience of the practice of mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness meditation. It can be uncomfortable. It forces you to face and experience things that normally we want to avoid at all cost. The practice of mindfulness is to face suffering and to see through this illusion that somehow suffering is a problem. Instead of trying to fix our problems, we try to see the suffering just as an experience. And when we come to see clearly, we will observe that suffering doesn't actually have any power to make us suffer. Pain, stress, hunger, all of the experiences that we have, seeing things that are ugly, hearing loud noises, smelling unpleasant smells, tastes, feelings, even thoughts. Thoughts that can be memories of terrible things that happened, or thoughts about the future, that terrible things that might happen, still don't have the power to make us suffer. Why we engage in the practice of mindfulness, the whole purpose of mindfulness, is to be able to face these things without stress, without suffering, without reacting to them. To see clearly that there's nothing dangerous about these things. So the first thing we can say is that there's no reason to ever react with greed, with anger, with delusion, act unethically in the face of suffering, because suffering isn't a problem. Suffering is merely another experience. But the other thing we can say about this, as I said, is that there's no intellectual reason to be concerned with hunger, malnutrition. There's no reason to try and protect ourselves even from death. And likewise, there's no reason to try to protect someone else. There's no reason to be concerned with war or famine or disease or natural disasters. There's reason to act as any ordinary person, normal, reasonable person would, and to help others, to support others, to do what you can, but simply as a matter of course. Getting upset and desperate and resorting to immorality, there's never any reason for that, because none of it is real. None of it is meaningful. Our death is just another death in the round of samsara. It doesn't have any meaning. Other people's death, suffering, even the horrors of hell, as awful as they might be when we read about them and learn about them, they're just a part of this cycle, the rounds of rebirth. We want to avoid them. We want to avoid suffering because we are unfamiliar. We aren't able to face reality. We aren't able to face such experiences, which is the very core of what it means to cultivate mindfulness, the ability to face, the ability to see clearly without any extrapolation or any meaning-making in the experiences. When you make this shift through the practice of mindfulness to experience reality as experiences, to see the things around you as not me or mine or people or places or things, but to see them just as experiences of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. You free yourself from all that need to fix and control and change the world around you. So it's a deeper, more profound message than just monks shouldn't lie about their attainments. And the verse drives this home. The verse makes clear that there's no excuse for these monks' behavior. But likewise, there's no real excuse in an ultimate sense for any sort of unwholesomeness, no matter what the suffering you might be trying to prevent or remove. He says, better that you did the most horrible suffering were to happen to you, swallowing a red-hot iron ball which would cause unimaginable suffering and death. That would be better than to do such a horrible thing as lie to someone. It's a hard lesson, because ask anyone in the world whether they would be willing to steal or lie or kill even to avoid such suffering. And most people would say yes, absolutely. Reasonably, understandably. Understandably, because they aren't capable of facing that sort of suffering. Most people aren't. Most meditators aren't. So it's not a indictment in that sense. I mean, obviously, it's an indictment of monks acting in such horrible ways as lying about their spiritual attainments. So that puts it in some perspective. But the verse doesn't even say that. It just says being unethical, and again, being unrestrained, uses the same word, asanyata, same word that we had in previous verses. A reminder that we're just talking about a mind that is untamed. The problem isn't suffering. The problem isn't how much you're suffering, and you shouldn't feel sad or discouraged because of how uncomfortable life might be, or how comfortable it might be. Don't be proud or attached to that. There's no meaning in that. Happiness doesn't lead to happiness, just as suffering doesn't lead to suffering. So no matter how happy you are, it doesn't make you a better person. As I said before in an earlier verse, the happiest people often become the most corrupt, because they become negligent and complacent and believe that they can do no wrong, that no matter what they do, the happiness will stay with them until it doesn't, until it runs out. And so we wind up in this cycle of happy people doing terrible things, and eventually they become people who suffer so much that they finally realize that all this immorality is not making things better, and they wind up in hell, where they're just incapable of avoiding suffering and realizing that if this is possible, then immorality isn't the answer. Lying and cheating and stealing isn't the solution, because it doesn't help me with hell, it doesn't help me with this. And so they come back again. They begin to be good, they change their attitude, and they fall into this cycle. This is the way of the untrained mind. When you train your mind, when you cultivate mindfulness to see clearly, to see all of the suffering and all of the evil and immorality, to see it just as experiences, you sort this all out. And you wash away all of the meaning-making, all of the conceptualizing of this is right, this is wrong, I deserve this. Any ideas of I deserve this, I don't deserve this, me, mine, are just washed away because they're not real. When you see clearly like that, you have no reason to think of acting unethically. And you don't ever suffer from pain, you don't ever suffer from hunger, these things don't bother you. You become this unthinkable, this unthinkable being who can withstand any sort of suffering, just that is unthinkable for ordinary individuals. So the lesson for us as meditators is to be able to separate evil and suffering, and to work to our best ability to free ourselves not from suffering but from evil, because freeing yourself from evil is what frees you from suffering. Trying to free yourself directly from suffering ultimately leads, for the most part, just to more evil, as you become averse to what you're experiencing. Rather than face it, rather than understand it, you cultivate aversion, which leads to anger, leads to beliefs like, I don't deserve this, this isn't right, this is a problem, that you have to fix it. And you fall into the trap of being able to do unethical deeds to avoid and remove suffering. And we should also appreciate the profound greatness of mindfulness practice to give us this unfathomable strength to face things that it's just unthinkable that anyone should be able to face them. And that it helps us to rise above this game of samsara, this game where we take things so seriously, things that have no meaning. We take ourselves so seriously, our physical health, we take the status of our family and our loved ones and people around us, this brief moment of time in time that we live as human beings, we take it so seriously, and we worry and we fret and we cling, trying to control and maintain this happiness that is so illusory and so ephemeral. And we stress and we suffer and we fall into unethical behaviors. And it's such a relief that we don't really have to. When we cultivate mindfulness, we come to see that it's all meaningless. That we don't really have to protect ourselves. We don't have to guard against suffering. Guarding against evil is enough. So that's the Dhamma for today. Thank you for listening.